With. I always like to start with a joke, but due to the Hollywood special effects of Charles H. Bennett, I've got something to share with you. This is an article Asher Peres and I wrote many years ago, and the Beside Zires wasn't part of the original title. That was Charles. So, some negative remarks on operational approaches. I'm awfully loud, aren't I? So I've been happy to see that this old slide of mine has gotten such airplay this week. I pulled it out of the bin, and I haven't used it in quite a long time. In fact, I think it was around 12 years ago at some meeting in Maryland when I first put the thing up. And at the time, it was mostly as an excuse to kind of make a joke at Max Tegmark, who was going around to meetings taking polls of which interpretation was the most popular at which meeting. And there was a hidden, well, it wasn't so hidden, it was pretty obvious agenda that he wanted to see many worlds climb in numbers as time went by so that he could say that the many worlds interpretation was the eminently reasonable one, and that's decided by democratic vote. All of that caused me to reflect upon just exactly what our mission at the time I didn't call myself Quantum Foundations, and I probably won't be calling myself Quantum Foundations after this meeting. But it caused me to reflect upon what exactly we needed to do as a community to get in a position that we would disband, that there wouldn't be any more Quantum Foundational meetings. How could we make this sort of stale debate on interpretation where numbers fluctuated from year to year, but otherwise that there was no great progress. How might we make that end? And the thing that struck me was that this slide actually said it all. This is one of our great physical theories, one of the great theories of physics, one of the two or three great theories of physics. And look how it's posed. I threw systems exist in. Associated with each system is a complex vector space, vectors, tensor products, all of these things. And compare that to one of our other great physical theories, special relativity, where one could make the statement of it in terms of some very crisp and clear physical principles. The speed of light is constant in all inertial frames, and physics, the laws of physics are the same in all inertial frames. And it struck me that if we couldn't take the structure of quantum theory and change it from this very overt mathematical speak, something that didn't look to have much physical content at all in a way that anyone could identify with some kind of physical principle, if we couldn't turn that into something like this, then the debate would go on forever and ever. And it seemed like a worthwhile exercise to try to reduce the mathematical structure of quantum mechanics to some crisp physical statements. Now, the reason I went in a direction like this, where I said, what would be a good methodology for doing that? And I landed upon going to each and every of the axioms and trying to give it an information theoretic reason, if possible, was that by that time I had already become pretty convinced that most of the structure of quantum theory was about information, and that quantum states represented information of some sort, or Bayesian degrees of belief, or some might say knowledge. But the question on my mind was, how much of quantum theory is about information? Just because some parts of it are about information, it didn't mean that all of it had to be about information. And I threw my money on the idea that there would be something about quantum theory that was not information theoretic. And so when I wrote the paper that I took this little image from, I wrote, of all these axioms, go to each and every one of them and give it an information theoretic reason, if possible. The distillate that remains, the piece of quantum theory with no information theoretic significance will be our first unadorned glimpse of quantum reality. Far from being the end of a journey, placing this conception of nature in open view will be the start of a great adventure. So that was really what I was seeking, was to try to tear away all of the underbrush that was about information and find the one piece or some small number of pieces of quantum theory that were actually statements about the world independent of information processing agents, independent of measuring observers, and so forth. So what I was really after was I wanted to know what made quantum systems go, what made them interesting and behave in some peculiar way. Could we pinpoint that one thing on a principle that wasn't written in information theoretic terms or operational terms in any way? So some time has passed, and there's been all of this fantastic work, and that's why I'm at this conference, because this has surprised me, the number of people that really threw their hearts and souls and have made all this great progress that we've seen here. I mean, we've seen some of these axiom systems. Here's the one of Chiarbella, Dariano, and Perinotti, the five axioms in one postulate, where they lay down the principle of causality, perfect distinguishability, ideal compression, local distinguishability, pure conditioning, purification. And out of that, all written in English, no mathematical equations, I like that, one pulls together the structure, the mathematical structure of quantum theory after a lot of work. But they nail it. And particularly, one thing I like about this system is the way they distinguish the purification postulate from the other axioms. This now approaches something that I think is along the lines of trying to find a crisp physical principle. But there have been other ones. I put all of you guys in alphabetical order, so not to offend anyone. Is it Dachic? How do you say your collaborator? Dachic. And Bruckner's axioms, information, capacity, locality, continuity. They haven't presented on this yet. I guess you will later in the conference. Hardy's new axioms. We saw his old axioms before, 10 years ago, and his new axioms this week. Definiteness, information locality, tomographic locality, compound permutability and preparability, and Massana's and Mueller's axioms. We've already seen this as well. Finiteness, local tomography, equivalence of subspaces, symmetry, all measurements are allowed. And we saw Alex Wolst's this morning written in a little bit more mathematical language. There are some equations in there. Well, when this whole business, or at least my discussions with Gilles Brassard and Charlie Bennett and many of you started up, I remember Charlie Bennett saying, well, how will you know when you get to this physical distillate of quantum theory? How will you know that you've reached the end of the process? And he sort of jokingly said, will it be like pornography? You know, the only way you know that it's pornography is if you see it. And I think he was right. Not in the way he wanted to be, but I think what I am having a difficulty with and what I want to try to express is that of all the progress that's been made, I haven't been able to look at these systems and see something that stands out at me as the essential core of quantum mechanics, something that's written in physical, non-operational, non-information theoretic terms. So there's been great progress in putting everything in operational terms and making that very clear, and one can do that. Can one do the opposite thing? Can one find some non-operational terms, have most of it in operational information theoretic terms, but perhaps not all of it? So I look at these systems and I say, what is the distillate that's left behind that I can say, this is the zing, this is the thing that makes quantum systems go? And I don't see it. So that's my basic point. How would I know it if I saw it? Back to Charlie's question. I'm not completely sure, but I think that there's a distinction between these two principles, which of course are girded up by some mathematics, as Lucien Hardy made clear. But I think there's a distinction between these principles and the ones that we've seen in the present efforts. And it's this. There's a certain amount of shock value in seeing the two things side by side. So they're not just sort of inert principles that are kind of there and they're equivalent to the structure of the theory. But instead, one of them says that the speed of light should be constant in all frames. And if you're accustomed to thinking, well, the speed of light should be, is this measurable quantity? How could it possibly be the same in all frames? So putting these two things together caused a certain amount of shock. And so I wonder whether quantum theory can be written in terms where the physical principle is identified as having a certain amount of shock value. I guess another thing that I'm trying to say is that of the existing axiomatic systems, it doesn't seem to me, at least, that any have quite gone for the jugular vein of quantum theory. So, you know, a werewolf, when it attacks a person, he'll jump at this vein and the person will bleed to death and it'll all be over with. I would like to see an axiomatic system that goes for the weirdest part of quantum theory of all. So, you know, for instance, most of them are built on the idea of local tomography, most of the ones in the list above. Is this a feature of quantum theory that's really weird? No. It doesn't seem to me that it's a feature that's really weird. And similarly with so many of the other ones. Can we find some axiomatic system that really goes after the weird part of quantum theory? Well, what is the weird part? What is the toy that one might want to go after for axiomatizing? Is it non-locality? We hear this word all the time in quantum information, in quantum foundations. My own sympathy, however, lies with something that Albert Einstein said, I believe in the 40s, and I guess it's in small print. I'll try to read it. Einstein on locality. If one asks what is characteristic of the realm of physical ideas independently of quantum theory, then above all, the following attracts our attention. The concepts of physics refer to a real external world. I'm okay with that. I.e., ideas are posited of things that claim a real existence independent of the perceiving subject, namely bodies, fields, etc. Moreover, it is characteristic of these physical things that they are conceived of as being arranged in a space-time continuum. Further, it appears to be essential for this arrangement of things introduced in physics that at a specific time, these things claim an existence independent of one another, insofar as these things lie in different parts of space. He puts scare quotes around lie in different parts of space, I presume because he's meaning that this is a tautology. We call things in different parts of space if they can't influence each other. Without such an assumption of mutually independent existence, this is the important part now, without such an assumption of a mutually independent existence, the being thus of spatially distant things, an assumption which originates in everyday thought, physical thought in the sense familiar to us would not be possible. Nor does one see how physical laws could be formulated and tested without such a clean separation. I think that maybe this is a debatable point in terms of detail, but I think the idea is fundamentally sound. If you first posit two systems and then you say, oops, made a mistake, they were really one after all, because any one system can influence any other one, it would be hard to imagine how we come across the usual sort of reasoning that we do. So my money is not on taking non-locality as the kind of shock value principle. Instead, I'm much more sympathetic with something that Asher Peres would have said, or did say, in around 78, unperformed experiments have no results. So if I were looking for a shock value principle to blame quantum mechanics on, my feeling is it's something along these lines. So So what is really at issue here? It's the question of whether quantum measurements reveal some pre-existing value for something that's unknown, or whether, in some sense, it goes toward creating the very value from the process of measurement. A good way to see how to pose this in more technical terms comes from, I guess I could call it a version of the free will theorem, but it's much older than Conway and Cochin. It has to do with first looking at the EPR criterion of reality. If without in any way disturbing a system, one can, these are my additions, one can gather the information required to predict with certainty, i.e. with probability equal to unity, the value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this physical quantity. So what's the content of that? Is it right? Well, you can consider a little variation of the EPR thought experiment. Let me take two Q-trits and put them in a maximally entangled state. And let me assume locality. Let me assume the principle that Einstein used in the quote that I used from him. And now consider making a measurement on the left-hand particle of some basis. Let's say this purple basis, or alternatively this green basis. I'm going to either choose the green one or the purple one. If I get, let's say, outcome number two on the left side, then, except for a transpose that I omitted in drawing in my picture, if I get outcome number two on the left side, then I can predict that if I were to make the measurement on the right side, I would get outcome number two. So under the assumption of locality, EPR would say, aha, it must be the case that there is an element of reality on this side corresponding to outcome number two of that measurement. It's something inherent in that body. But similarly, we could talk about looking at the other measurement. And if I were to get, let's say, outcome two for that measurement, I could predict with certainty that I would get outcome two for the other measurement. So we're talking about non-commuting variables here, and EPR by the EPR criterion and locality, they would say it must be the case that there were elements of reality associated with those non-commuting observables. But we could make this more extreme and not just consider two observables, but consider a whole set of them, quite a lot of them, corresponding to one of the Cochin-Specker constructions, for instance, the one that that Asher-Perez found. So by taking a sufficient number of orthogonal bases and interlocking them in some interesting way, we can construct a non-colorable set. So for each of these, we would have said, by making a measurement here, I draw an inference about the element of reality over here. And so I can do it for one, I can do it for another, I can do it for another. I can't do it for all of them without running into troubles. So I would say the thing that this teaches me is that there's something bankrupt, not in locality, but something bankrupt in the EPR criterion of reality. There's something wrong about that. And that's what I'm calling Perez's principle that unperformed measurements have no outcomes, particularly that quantum probabilities aren't probabilities for some pre-existent reality that we're finding when we perform a measurement, but instead that's something that's produced in the process of measurement. So what would excite me in an axiomatic approach to quantum reconstruction? I think it would be if someone could find a set of axioms that pulled this idea to the forefront and really made it the core of things. Now, I don't know how to do that at all. But I have a little toy approach that I've been playing with for some time that pleases me, at least. And that is to recognize that these considerations of Cochin-Specker, and including this case where we've got the locality assumption, rests on thinking about different experiments in terms of each other. We think about what happens if we perform one experiment, we think about what happens if we were to perform another one. And it tells us that contextuality is at the core of the considerations. So what I would like as a goal is to find some way to push quantum theory's specific form of contextuality all into one corner. If I could show that all of the phenomena of Cushing-Specker and Bell inequality violations and everything else, the whole formal structure, comes out of one corner to do with something with contextuality, I think I would be pleased. So let me give you a progress report on that kind of idea. To give you the report, I have to make use of a little device that I've told so many of you about so many times, a particularly interesting measuring device that I would like to elevate to a standard quantum measurement. It would be an informationally complete measurement. In other words, if I knew the statistics of the outcomes of this measurement, I would be able to reconstruct the quantum state that gave rise to that. That's what I mean by this here. I'm getting rid of this symbol rho, which represents a quantum state, and putting in its place a probability distribution. This probability distribution refers to the probabilities of the outcomes of this measurement up in the sky. And if this is an informationally complete measurement, we can completely reconstruct the quantum state that I've X'd out from the probabilities. Particularly, to make everything that I say have a pretty form, it should have the following properties. Suppose you could find d squared projection operators, d squared rank one projection operators, with this nice symmetry condition, namely that the Hilbert-Schmidt interproduct between any two of the projection operators is equal to a constant value determined by the dimension, 1 over d plus 1. If you can find d squared projection operators satisfying this symmetry, then you can prove that they have to be linearly independent. They don't have a choice. And moreover, if you renormalize by 1 over the dimension, then they'll sum up to the identity. So these form the elements of a POVM, so they can be thought of as the outcomes of a quantum measurement. Since it's informationally complete, then I don't seem to have a light. Well, since it's informationally complete, one can completely determine the quantum state in terms of the probabilities. So here are the probabilities for the outcomes given by the Born rule. And because of this great symmetry that they have, there's a lovely reconstruction formula that says the initial quantum state is just a linear combination of these projection operators where the expansion coefficients are determined in terms of the probabilities in a really simple way, just a nice little affine transformation. If you now explore what does a state space look like in terms of the probabilities, well, if we were talking about these density operators, we'd say, well, we know what the state space looks like. It's a set of positive semi-definite matrices with trace 1. But what does the state space look like in terms of the probabilities themselves? Well, it's this. You can express the extreme points. I wish I had a pointer. You can express the extreme points. My fingers in front of it? Ah, that's a simple solution. Okay, so let's go back to this formula. If you put an arbitrary probability distribution in here over d squared outcomes, you have to get a Hermitian matrix just because this is a real combination of projection operators. So you'll always get a Hermitian matrix. But for certain choices of the probabilities, you won't necessarily get a positive semi-definite one. What this tells you is that if you want to specify the set of rank one positive semi-definite operators, then all you have to add to the condition that you have a Hermitian operator is that the trace of the operator squared and the trace of operator cubed is equal to 1. And if you translate that into a condition on the probabilities, you get two equations. One says that the probabilities should lie on the surface of a sphere of a certain radius, and the other one says that they should satisfy a certain cubic condition that isn't necessarily very pretty. But what you can glean from this is that the extreme points are the intersection, form the intersection of two sets, one of which is a sphere and one of which is some cubic curve. So the pure states can't be the whole sphere unless this last condition is going to be trivial. It's going to be some subset of a sphere. Well, what does all of this have to do with contextuality and maybe a reconstruction of quantum theory by some means associated with contextuality? You can start to get a sense of what that has to do with this by looking at this following little thought experiment. Here's what I'm going to do. I've got my quantum system, and I'm going to throw it into some measuring device. I'll call it the measuring device on the ground. Let's say it's a von Neumann measuring device. So I'm going to throw this quantum system into here, and when I do, it'll generate an outcome. Let me call it J. What I'd like to know is, what are the probabilities for the outcomes of these outcomes J, or here I wrote it DJ to evoke the idea of data, P of DJ. That's what I'd like to calculate. I'm going to throw it in here. I'm really going to do this. Throw it in there, get an outcome. But suppose I only know the probabilities for the outcome of this very special seek measurement, and I know the conditional probabilities for the outcomes of the measurement on the ground in terms of the measurement in the sky. So in other words, I have conditional probabilities, P of DJ given HI. Do I have enough information to reconstruct the probability that I really want? The probability that I really want is one that I get by throwing my quantum system into this second measuring device via a coherent path. There's no measurement on it. There's no decoherence. Alternatively, the probabilities I'm given are ones to do with this imaginary path, an incoherent path. Well, you might be able to reconstruct it, but you can't use regular probability theory. You can't just say that the probabilities for the outcomes of the bottom path will be given by the classical formula to do with probability, the conditional probabilities through the upper path, because as I said, in physics terms, one of them is a coherent process and the other one is an incoherent process. If you speak like a probabilist or like Leslie Ballantyne when he was here, and I made this slide for him, you might say, well, there are extra conditions. One of them refers to one experiment, one probability. The probability on the left-hand side refers to one experiment. And the probabilities on the right-hand side refer to a different experiment. So there's an extra conditional in these expressions. And it's no wonder that you don't get equality in the classical expression because there are extra conditions floating about. What is so interesting in this case, however, is that though all of that is true, it's true that you can't just use the classical formula for the upper path to calculate the lower path. Quantum mechanics nonetheless provides the tools for making the calculation. It's just a different calculation. And the calculation it is this. You do the old classical calculation, first form this, the usual Bayesian approach, and then you simply stretch the answer a little bit by a factor that depends upon the dimension and renormalize. So whereas just raw probabilistic considerations say there must be an inequality, or at least there can be an inequality in this expression, quantum mechanics restores equality by changing the formula a little bit. Quantum mechanics adds something, gives some extra structure to probability theory that just raw, plain probability theory itself doesn't have. So again, just to emphasize, to get this answer, you just do the classical calculation, and then to get the Born rule, you simply modify the classical calculation ever so little to get the answer. Yeah? No, there are going to be some other theories that can do this. Well, so the point of view that I'm taking here is that there's this thing called probability theory. And probability theory would say, whenever there are extra conditions floating about, then we can't make equality. Now, you might say, I add some extra structure to probability theory that will allow me to reinstate the equality. Now, can all theories do that? I'm not sure. Quantum theory can do it in one special case. The one special case it can do it is if this is one of these seek measurements. It doesn't have such a simple reconstructive formula for other measurements up in the sky. Okay. So this causes me to wonder whether this is the kind of corner where I can push all of contextuality. So the contextuality here is that I've got the calculation for the probabilities directly for the ground path in terms of the probabilities for the sky path, and the formula is modified. Can we take this diagram and this maybe I shouldn't call it modified law of total probability, this addition to probability theory, as a fundamental postulate of quantum mechanics? Well, what is one wanting to get out of it? Well, the thing that you would like to get out of it is a specification of this convex set that we were talking about earlier. Can it be that this formula somehow implies the convex set that we were talking about, where I had the sphere intersecting a cubic curve? Well, it might imply some features of it, and you can already see that it might because of the following. Suppose the term under the sum here were a number that was near zero, or zero, in fact. Well, if the number were zero, then we would have zero minus one, and that would lead to a negative number on the left-hand side. So we wouldn't actually have a probability on the left-hand side. We might have something you call negative probability, but negative probability isn't probability. Alternatively, suppose the number here were close to 1, or in fact 1 itself, then it would be d plus 1 minus 1. That would be d, and that would be larger than 1. So again, this term under the sum can't be too large. Otherwise, we'll end up with something that is not a proper probability itself either. So it gives some hope that making this formula hold will give us something like a convex structure and something along the right variety. Okay, so what I really want to do, so that was all tricksterism. I don't really want to take this one statement as a postulate of quantum mechanics. My starting point should be to consider the most general case, not just where I have a von Neumann measurement on the ground, but I have any kind of measurement whatsoever on the ground. And you can prove that the rule gets a little modified when we consider completely general positive operator valued measures on the ground. The thing that changes is that there's an extra conditional term underneath the sum. So in the case where we have a von Neumann measurement, then all of these terms under the sum, they sum up to 1, in fact. So we get this extra little term that's outside of the sum. I'm going to change my notation slightly because I have more equations to show you. And the notational change will be this. I'm going to call the quantum probability, the thing that the Born rule calculates for us, Q of J. I'll call the prior probabilities for the measurement in the sky P of I. And I'll call these conditional probabilities for the ground given the sky R of J given I. Well, here's what I want to show you, that nearly the consistency of this equation alone, and I say nearly, you have to take that a little bit with a grain of salt, but for me it's nearly. Nearly the consistency of this equation alone implies a significant non-trivial convex structure. You don't just end up with a sphere. You don't end up with a cube. You don't end up with any polytope. You end up with something that you don't see discussed much in these circles, at least as far as I've seen. So here's the nearly. Here's a property that I'm going to add to that axiom. It's a property that quantum mechanics has. Suppose your initial state is the complete garbage state, 1 over d times the identity, and you actually follow the path in the sky. So in our diagram, we throw the garbage state up into the sky. It goes through the sick POVM, and it comes down to the ground for some new POVM. I'll call it G sub J. So those are the elements of it. Suppose I look at the outcome J and try to make an inference to what happened up in the sky. Well, then I would just use normal Bayes' rule to calculate the probability for the outcome I in the sky given the outcome J on the ground. And it just works out to be this, trace of this GJ operator times pi I over D, trace GJ. Now let me redefine this GJ over trace GJ and call it a density operator. Then look at this probability. The probability for getting I in the sky given J on the ground is just one of these seek representations of the quantum state rho J. So this is generated by a hidden quantum state rho sub J. Moreover, any rho sub J can be gotten in this way by choosing the measurement on the ground to be an appropriate POVM. Okay, so that's a property of quantum mechanics, that for any POVM, we can generate a quantum state this way, and vice versa. Well, all that was really a statement of was the combination of using Bayes' rule and using this operator representation. So I'm going to promote this to an axiom. Starting from a state of maximal uncertainty for the sky, one can use the posterior state supplied by Bayes' rule as a valid prior state. So we do this all the time. Whenever you gather data, you take your prior, you turn it into a posterior, and then you use that later on for your next prior. So that's all that this rule is telling you. And I've particularized it to having complete ignorance in the sky. Well, that leads to an immediate consequence for our formula, because if we just write out the formula, but now suppose that for any of the R, J, I's in the previous formula, we could write it as one of these posteriors, then we just rewrite it to this. But we demand that this number on the left be non-negative. So that tells us that the thing in the square brackets here has to be non-negative. And by the postulate above, this probability of I given J is just some other quantum state where I use the quotes. It's some other state. And if we want this to be non-negative, then it says that the inner product of these two states is bounded below. So within the probability simplex, if I have a point that's a valid state and I have another point that's a valid state, in other words, one that doesn't violate the condition here, their inner products can't be too small. So that's a non-trivial condition, I would say. Okay, let me now point out another thing. If we're going to be consistent, if we have the measurement in the sky and we have the measurement on the ground, then it has to be the case to do the calculation for a measurement on the ground that's exactly the same as the measurement in the sky. And we can calculate this in two ways. We can say, well, there's the usual expression for the probability for the measurement in the ground, and then there's the one that's given by our formula. Well, if this is going to hold, then the only conditional probabilities that can be allowed are ones of this sort. And now we use the reciprocity axiom, the one previously, the one about Bayes' rule, to turn these into actual states. So it says that among our sets of states, just because of the existence of these two measuring devices, we have to have these states among them, ones that are flat all except for at one point, and particularly with this normalization. And here's something to notice about these guys. If we take their inner products with themselves, for each of them we get this value. So since these correspond to the very special measuring device, let me think of these as being among the extreme points of the set. Extreme in the sense that this value takes its largest possible one. So this leads to the following notion. I'll call a set S within the simplex that contains these points that we know it must contain, the basis states from the previous one. I'll call it consistent if for any two points within it, their inner product is bounded below by the general bound that we had to have, and it's bounded above by the ones that these extreme points attain. And I'll call it maximal if adding any further point makes it inconsistent. So if I have a set for which every pair of points satisfies this, and I add just one more point to it from the simplex, if all of a sudden this condition is violated, then I say it's inconsistent. If it violates it, then the set was maximal. Okay, so here's an example of a maximal consistent set. If S is the set of quantum states itself, it is a consistent and maximal set. I'll show you that on the next slide. But as a general problem, and related to Luca's question, it'd be nice to characterize all such sets. So we know that quantum state space is among them, but what else is among them? So let me show you that quantum state space is a maximal consistent set. Suppose I use my seek representation to turn two probability distributions into operators. Well, it just works out that the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product of these operators can be written in terms of the normal Euclidean inner product of the probability distributions. Suppose the first one doesn't correspond to a quantum state. Well, it's Hermitian, and so if it's not going to correspond to a quantum state, that means it has to have a negative eigenvalue. Well, okay, if it has a negative eigenvalue, let me choose the other one to be the projection onto the direction that gives the negative eigenvalue on this, and I see that I generate
a Hilbert Schmidt interproduct that's less than or equal to zero, and consequently, these interproducts of probabilities have to be smaller than our bound. So quantum state space, there's nothing you can add to it. It's as large as it can be and satisfy the consistency condition. Okay, so quantum state space is in there, but what other properties do these maximally consistent sets have along the lines of quantum mechanics? Well, a little argument, you can convince yourself that if it's going to be maximal, then for any 2 points, it has to contain the convex combination of the 2 points. So it has to be, maximal sets have to be convex sets. Let some other point be in the closure of the set. Then there has to be a sequence leading up to the point in the closure. And as long as it's contained within the consistent set, for any other point in the consistent set, it'll satisfy these conditions. So consequently, this point in the closure has to be in there. So maximal consistent sets are closed. So we have closed and convex sets just from these two conditions. Okay, in what sense do we get non-trivial sets? Well, there's already a sense in which you get a pretty non-trivial set just from the lower bound of the maximal consistency condition. So if I have a point that is here, and for any point that's allowed in my set, there has to be some point in the opposite side of the sphere around the antipode of the sphere that can't be allowed. There has to be a non-included region. So for any point, there's an excluded spot on the opposite side of the sphere, which is pretty strange. Moreover, we've got this property that the particular size of the sphere, if we renormalize things so that we're looking within the probability simplex, you can see that the size of the sphere that we're talking about is actually, the radius of it reaches outside of the simplex for sufficiently large faces, for sufficiently high dimensional faces. So whatever the object is here, not only does it have the property that I just told you about, that opposite sides are excluded, but also we have that it's larger than the simplex that it's sitting in, so it has to be the intersection of a sphere and a simplex. Here's another interesting property. You might ask yourself, is there some kind of bound to the number of zeros that can be within a probability vector? And you can use the Schwarz inequality to show that indeed there is a bound on the number of zeros that can be contained in some probability vector within this set. Well, this automatically implies, well, the lower bound implies that there are certain asymmetries to this set. So it started off in a very symmetric way. But suppose you achieve this bound with the number of zeros. So we have some probability vector that has a lot of zeros and then some other values. Well, okay, so suppose that that one's a good point. Alternatively, consider another one where I've just rotated around and I've moved my zeros over here. That might still be a good point. But generally, it'll be the case that if I take all of my zeros and shuffle them to the other side of the vector, all of a sudden the inner product bound will be violated. So it's not the case that all permutations of the vectors have to be allowed within the set. All of these things are picking up features that the cubic equation in the quantum state space specification imply. So, you know, it's a nice simple condition, but it has lots of consequences. And all of these things are consequences of the cubic condition, not the quadratic condition. Here's one last one. Yeah, well, you started me 5 minutes late. I didn't notice that. Okay, so last line. One last little property that I think is cute. Suppose we have a set of vectors within one of these maximally consistent sets, and they're all of the largest length possible, given by the bound, and moreover, they all have the smallest inner product allowed by the bound. Here's the question I'd like to ask. For ones of this variety, is there some maximum number of elements within the set? How many can be there? Well, you can see how many can be there just by forming this combination and knowing that the g dot g has to be greater than or equal to zero. You calculate that out and you get this expression. This expression can only be non-negative if m is less than or equal to d. So it says that we've started with a simplex of size d squared. And if we make the demand that we've got a set of points that are maximally distant from each other, we can't have more than d of them. So again, this mimics quantum state space. So we start with a set of size of dimension d squared, and there's a kind of underlying set of size d. So, challenge. What further postulates must be made to recover precisely quantum state space? I don't know. Maybe they'll get really horrible. Maybe it won't be the pretty principle that I want at all. But I feel that at least this is moving in the direction of focusing on contextuality as a primitive notion within quantum theory and the particular flavor of contextuality. But of course, this is what we really want, this thing that John Wheeler said: if one really understood the central point and its necessity in the construction of the world, one ought to be able to state it in one clear, simple sentence. And so I hope you guys keep trying to do that. Thank you.
Chris, we did start 5 minutes late, so I'm going to allow five now for questions. Do we have any questions?
Why go around and stand up?
Hi. So maybe first a comment and then a more specific question. The way I see it, in terms of this program of finding sort of postulates or axioms or whatever, is that we're looking at some strange object. And the original mathematical axioms of quantum theory sort of give us a bunch, five or however many there are, of strange vantage points on this strange object. You know, maybe we're looking at it from odd directions. And as we get better postulates, we're finding better ways to look at it from. So rather than looking at it from some sort of direction that it doesn't really make sense, we see it face on, and we see it from several different directions. And so we're sort of moving towards sort of some more reasonable set of vantage points on a given object. So then it wouldn't disturb us, of course, whether these axioms are unique or not. At least they should somehow be a sort of sensible way of looking at that object. It was just a sort of general comment, but then the particular point was, you said that you thought that this equation could be a possible postulate, but you also said that you liked it when postulates were expressed in words. So do you have some words for that equation?
No, that's my big failure.
Okay,
at this point. I liked your analogy at the beginning, and I guess maybe it gives me the tool to express that it seems that the light has been shining in ways that it kind of takes the corners off of the edge of quantum. So we've got this very sharp, rather jagged object called quantum theory, and the lights that have been shined on it have made it like a little distinction from classical theory in usual ways, like, for instance, in Giulio and Mauro and Paolo's postulates. You know, they can pinpoint it to one spot, and you can as well, and in some of the other axioms. So it feels to me like it's kind of dulling. The projection of it is smoother than the real object itself. Itself is, but you know, for your question, yeah, it's a shortcoming. I don't have any explanation of this equation that is giving some structure, other than to know that it works. I've tried to play games to do with Dutch book arguments and, you know, some kind of picture of the world that, you know, I have these, like Gilles. You see, Gilles was my teacher. He has conversations with God. I've had conversations with God where I imagine that God says, you know, I ask him, I want the ability to write messages upon the world. And God says, you know, I can give you that. But that means that the world is going to have some loose play in it, because if it were a rigid thing, then you wouldn't be able to write messages in it. And then he says, Bob, at the moment I give you some loose play in the world, then I may not be able to predict all the floods and fires for you anymore, because it's got all of this loose play in it. So anyway, I've played little games like that associated with Dutch books, and I've gotten nowhere.
So presumably when you are considering your measurement in the sky, the imaginary measurement in the sky, you're using some particular state update rule associated with that. Is that the...
some particular what?
State update rule. So after the imaginary measurement, you imagine the state updates.
Sure.
So which rule is that? Is that just the square
root? It's just the Luders rule. So, if I were more careful, and, you know, anyone who knows about the distinction between effects and operations, they immediately say, an effect doesn't specify an operation. And I say, yes, you're right. But I was trying to be fast and quick. So really what I'm imagining for the box in the sky is a particular state update rule.
So then another question is that Chris Fuchs from 10 years ago had a different idea of which state update rule was like Bayesian updating.
Ah.
So what happens if you change that Luders update to 10 years ago Chris Fuchs rule?
Yeah. Well, it would go nasty, wouldn't it? Because the other state update rule explicitly depends upon the prior. It depends upon the quantum state. So you have something that's a collapse, and then you have a state-dependent extra-unitary operation. So, you know, the thing that's always been nice about Luders' rule is you don't need that part. You don't need that part for specifying, you know, what the update rule is. But I thought that it obscured certain features, as you know. I haven't thought about that. I mean, other than I can see that it would just be nasty because it would depend upon the initial quantum state. And I've been striving to have conditionals that don't depend upon the quantum state. And in particular, that's what motivates not only the symmetry condition, but motivates the POVM in the sky consisting of rank one projection operators, which makes it a hard mathematical problem.
I can see that there are more questions. I'm wondering if we should move on, though. We're sort of 10 minutes past the start of the next one now. So would it be all right to thank Chris again, and other people can talk to him later?